I am the Martian ambassador. We come in peace. We come in peace. We come in peace. We come in peace.
You know, that's just like your opinion, man.
It's time for Shouts from the Back Row, the official podcast of the-back-row.com. My name is Gil, and I'm your host. And with me, as always, are my co-hosts, Robin.
Hello.
And TK.
Hello.
On our last episode, we were inspired by the release of The Fate of the Furious to discuss the career of Dwayne Johnson. And in talking about The Rock and The Fate of the Furious, we realized that there was another actor in that film who was completely deserving of a podcast episode dedicated to their career. And that actor is Helen Mirren. Dame Helen Mirren, I can't believe she hasn't come up more on the show before. Trained at the Royal Shakespeare Company, Helen Mirren exudes class and has this trademark commanding demeanor. So I even feel a bit humbled by the fact, or perhaps scared in a way, that we have not devoted a show to her. Well, we're going to remedy that right now, because on this episode we'll be talking about our favorite Helen Mirren roles and much more right after this. The Back Row is dedicated to delivering free entertainment to everyone in the forms of media culture blogging, movie reviews, short films, podcasts, and more. That's awesome, I hear you say, and you're right, it is pretty awesome. So why don't you help us out by subscribing to our podcast on iTunes and leaving a review? Just search the iTunes store for Shouts from the Back Row to subscribe to our feed, and if you're feeling generous, visit the-back-row.com and click the donate button to send us a few bucks. Your support means the world to us. We like to open the show with a discussion of what we've been up to. This is a place for us to talk about movies we've been watching, TV shows we've been following, games we've been playing, and just about everything else we've been doing. So, TK, what have you been up to?
I sadly haven't been up to a whole lot. I have caught up with Fargo, which I've been immensely enjoying. David Thewlis has been a horrifying, terrible creep in this, and I love him ever that much more for it.
What episode are you on? Sorry, what episode?
The third one. I haven't caught up with this week's yet. But David Thewlis is a lot of fun to watch. Ewan McGregor is doing a great job playing twins, and I really enjoy Fargo. I like the atmosphere they create and like the accents, and I think the directors do a really good job like encapsulating what the film is supposed to be about as well. But the series has been on a life of its own, and it's kind of fun to watch it like change and evolve. And it's like this week's episode left Minnesota completely, and I thought that was really interesting the way they took that on. It keeps you guessing the whole series, and I'm fond of it. I think it's a really interesting way to tackle things. Gil, you've been catching up, I assume?
I think I'm actually one or two episodes behind on it. I've been watching many other things, but I'm a little behind on Fargo. However, like you, as we've discussed previously on the podcast, I really love where this season is going. And I continue to be impressed with, I guess it's Noah Hawley is sort of the mind behind the Fargo TV series. I continue to be impressed with his ability to capture the atmosphere of Fargo and that particular brand of Coen Brothers films where it's like about suburbia and crime and like middle class crime in a way, but always involving things like money and murder. It's really neat seeing a show capture that atmosphere without being a Coen Brothers, like it's barely related to the movie. It's just sort of inspired by the Coen Brothers, and somehow it works. Somehow it is not just like a fan film. So I'm really curious to see where this season is going, and I love the cast so far. And yeah, everything's on track for another great season of Fargo.
Yeah, it's been great. I'm really enjoying to see where the season goes. I also watched Guardians of the Galaxy 2 this week, which was a good time. I think I enjoyed the first one a bit better. I did enjoy Kurt Russell in this. I liked a lot of the, I don't want to say throwaway gags, but a lot of like the actors that started popping up, like Stallone and things like that. It was fun. But I found the humor a little off. Like, the jokes you could see coming pretty far away. And while I enjoyed Baby Groot, I felt he had a little too much screen time. And I felt that Peter Quill was kind of like, kind of static. I think that's the best way I can describe him. Like, I feel that we've seen a trope like this too, like, an awful lot. They didn't do a whole lot new with it. So, regardless to say, I enjoy, it's still a really fun Marvel movie. And I like the weird off the wall stuff the Guardians do. And that's one of the reasons I'm looking forward so much to Thor Ragnarok, because it looked like it's going to take that same vein. It looks like it'll be a lot of fun. But I enjoyed my viewing. I thought it was a good time.
I saw it as well. Robin, did you see Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2?
Not yet. Didn't get a chance this week.
I have a lot of similar opinions to you, TK. I thought it was a worthy sequel. I really appreciate that this is like James Gunn's baby. It shows. I was watching the Red Letter Media review of it, and they commented how this doesn't feel like a film designed by committee. A lot of Marvel films feel like they're sort of a checklist. It's especially egregious with things like maybe Ant-Man or, you know, Iron Man 2 is probably the biggest example of this, but where they just sort of feel paint by numbers. They feel kind of samey. And what's neat about Guardians of the Galaxy is because it was just written by James Gunn, like, there are good setups and payoffs, and even though I also preferred the first one, I still really, really like that, like, all the characters get resolutions. They're nice little story arcs. There's nothing, like, left hanging. Everything fits together really neatly, and even tiny little side characters who are barely cameos, like Sylvester Stallone's character, he has kind of an arc as well, where he forgives Yondu. Spoilers, I'm not going to spoil too much, but he forgives Yondu for, like, a slight in his past. And it's kind of awesome, because he's just this little side character that doesn't factor too much into the main plot. And yet, even down to those side characters, everything pays off. Everybody's got, like, a little story, and it's tight. It's tightly written. So I really liked that. I also really like Kurt Russell in this. And even though coming out of the screening, I was like, that was good. It was okay. Like, I wasn't totally jazzed by it. I fully admit that a week later, it worked. I'm still listening. I'm listening to, you know, Awesome Mix Volume 2. I'm humming the tunes. And I'm thinking back on it about all these things that I really like. Lots of really small things and big things as well. So, you know, I think it succeeds. And my knee-jerk, it's funny, if you follow me on Letterboxd, you'll see when I first see a movie, I'll have like a knee-jerk rating, and then it will probably shift about a week later as I think about the movie more. And in this case, it's going to go up. My knee-jerk rating for Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 was 3 out of 5, which is a respectable, but, you know, it's fine. But I think it's probably going to go up to 3.5 after some reflection. I feel the urge to revisit it, and it's still just so weird and cool and wacky that, I don't know, it stands apart from a lot of other movies that are coming out right now. Like, there's a sequence involving a hyperspace jump that is so bizarre, you would never think that it exists in the same Marvel universe as the Avengers. Like, it is just so cartoony and wacky that it really does set itself apart. It's going to be strange watching all of the various threads of the Marvel Cinematic Universe collide simply because of how bizarre Guardians of the Galaxy is, with its talking jetpack raccoon and its grumpy baby tree and a blue Michael Rooker. It's so way out there. So I have gained greater appreciation in hindsight. Then up to anything else, TK?
Honestly, that's about it. No, actually, I'm going to talk about a book series I just finished. I've had my eye on this book's trilogy called the Powder Mage Trilogy for the last probably year and a half, and I finally picked up the books the other day. It's by an author named Brian McKellen. And this is probably the most entertaining book series I've read in probably about a half a year or so, because it's essentially the French Revolution with wizards who get high off gunpowder, and it's really cool. And I blew through the three books in like a week, in like 8 days or something. And it's well worth reading if you're a big fan of high fantasy. They're well worth picking up. They're an absolute blast. And the author just started another book that's set in the same universe with the start of a new trilogy, and it just dropped last week or the week before. But highly recommend it. They're very good.
Robin, what have you been up to?
Well, I went to see Gil in Toronto this past weekend because I was going to see a wrestling show, a Ring of Honor show, and while I was there, I decided to see Gil in person for the first time in about a year or so, and we saw some movies together, which I want to talk about. The first one we saw, which we saw at the Varsity Cinema in downtown Toronto, was The Lost City of Z, and we decided to pick this one because it's pretty much a mysterious story. It's about a guy named Percy Fawcett, this famous British explorer who explored the Amazon several times, and in 1925 he went in there with his son Jack, and they never came out and were never seen again. And I was kind of hoping that the whole movie would be about this particular expedition, but unfortunately this is what I like to call a Wikipedia biopic, where you think that the people who wrote it went to his Wikipedia page, looked at all the highlights from his life, and just tried to kind of jam them all into one movie. Because they try to get through all these highlights that Fawcett went through, and he lived a very interesting life, but it gives the movie kind of a disjointed feel, because he didn't just go into the Amazon in 1925, he went there like three times on an expedition to find like this lost city of gold. But the problem is that they show him going down there once, then he comes back, has issues with his family, then he goes back again, and then they show him going off to fight in World War I, which feels like it belongs to a completely different movie, and then his expedition into the jungle with his son is only in the last act of the movie, and they barely even cover that at all, even though that's pretty much the most interesting part of the story. So it feels like it should have been a better structure. Like, it's just kind of a straightforward linear account of his life, and I feel it would have been a lot more interesting if they rarely ever left the jungle, because that's what good jungle movies do. Stuff like Aguirre, The Wrath of God, is like they show what a hellacious, horrific environment is it by spending nearly the entire movie here. But here he's in the jungle for a little while and goes through some mild inconveniences, and then they just kind of, the story goes back to England. So you don't really get the sense of awe in it. I mean, it's a very well photographed movie, well acted, I guess, and it's not boring. It kept my interest from beginning to end, but I think it would have been so much more, and that they should have focused only on one aspect of Fawcett's life, and it would have been a much stronger picture. And I think I saw it with Gil and Caitlin, and they pretty much thought the exact same thing, that this is a movie with a lot of potential, but it pretty much missed the mark.
Yep, I absolutely agree, and The sad thing as well is that it was sort of marketed as like an explorer in the jungle movie, a jungle expedition film. And so I do wonder if part of my disappointment with it was just feeling misled by the advertisement. But to be fair, that is the most interesting thing about this guy's life, is him exploring the Amazon. And it's a shame that they decided instead to just do this very straightforward biopic. This is the kind of story where you really should take some artistic liberties. I don't think anybody's going to be that insulted if you make this real character into, you know, like a bit more of an explorer type, as opposed to just being this stern family man who we see. You know, here's a prime example of how the movie needed some adaptation applied. It needed just a little bit of fictionalization to really make it a cool story. The film opens with Fawcett on like a big British deer hunt, and he's the one who kills the deer. He's the greatest hunter of all of them. And there's some discussion at a dinner about how he has sort of like a tainted bloodline. His name, his father had smeared the family name, and then the next scene, we get a telecard where it's like 2 years later, and someone rides up and is like, "You've been reposted to the Royal Geographic Society," and it's the kind of thing where it's like, yeah, factually that happened 2 years later, but from a story perspective, it's sort of like, well, what happened in those 2 years? Why did they show us that first scene and skip 2 years ahead immediately? It completely interrupts your investment in the character, because these huge swaths of his life are being cut up. The sequences where they're, you know, exploring in the jungles, it doesn't feel like they go very far because those sequences are compressed. You know, it doesn't feel like they actually spend too much time in the jungle before they reach their destination, go, we found it, and then, oh, he's back in, like, Ireland, or he's off in World War One. So I really found the structure of the film to be a bit of a tension killer. You know, there was no sense of, like, ramping up to something. Instead, it was just, like, these little vignettes, each of which explained a different part of his life. And I kind of felt, too, by the end of the film, that it could have been solved just with a slightly different structure. If we'd had him, you know, chopping his way through the jungle in his final expedition, what would end up being the last expedition he went on, and then you'd sort of intercut it with these flashbacks to, you know, his time in World War One, or just previous encounters that have meaning to the current situation of the framing narrative. I don't know. As it stands, though, I you know, as you said, Robin, it's beautifully shot. I loved that it was all practical. It reminded me of, you know, how good just straight-up filmmaking can be when all you need are costumes and sets, and you don't need big special effects or huge explosions or, you know, much of that stuff. But as far as actual content, it's a bit of a slog. My Letterboxd review for this one says, for a movie that's about searching for a specific destination, it sure had no idea where it was going half the time. It really just meanders around. So yeah, right there, yep, with you, Robin. This was sadly a disappointment.
That line pretty much sums it up perfectly, I think. And while I was visiting Gil, I also checked out two other very, very bizarre movies. One of them I finally got a chance to watch was The Greasy Strangler, which Gil has talked about on previous episodes. And it was compared to Street Trash because of how trashy and dirty it is, but it actually makes Street Trash look like kids play. This is a very, very bizarre movie, and it actually delivers what the title promises. It's about a strangler who rubs grease all over his body before he goes out to strangle people. And he's played by a very weird looking old guy named Michael St. Michaels, who was apparently a hairdresser before this. And he does a lot of his scenes with a floppy, very large penis dangling right there in front of the camera, which shows you what type of movie it is. And it focuses a lot on his relationship with his son and the fact that they both take turns having sex with his son's girlfriend, and it fractures the relationship. In spite of, like, and a lot of gross scenes of him, like, eating grease and stuff like that, there's no context to a lot of the stuff that's in the movie. Like, it's not just a horror movie. It's a really bizarre black comedy that gets a lot of its humor out of the fact that it will prolong scenes on and on and on. Like, 5 minutes in, there's a scene where he's going in, like, giving a tour to all these people, and they complain because he offered them free drinks, and they pretty much shout back and forth, "No free drinks! No fucking free drinks!" And it goes on for, like, nearly 5 minutes. There are a lot of scenes in this movie of people arguing the same points over and over again, like, "You're a bullshit artist! No, you're a bullshit artist!" And it becomes tedious, but then it somehow becomes funny again just because of how long they stretch it out. And you wind up laughing in spite of yourself. And really, there's so much in this movie that doesn't make any sense, and I don't know if I would call it good, but it's just so fascinating to watch. And the fact that its director, Jim Hosking, is actually going on to, like, bigger things after this. Like, he's directing a movie with Jermaine Clement and Aubrey Plaza and stuff, and you would think that a guy who made a movie like this would never work again, but he somehow got Elijah Wood to be one of the producers on this movie, so it's become kind of a cult hit. So yeah, I would not recommend this for anyone, but if you're a fan of stuff like Street Trash and you want to see, like, a horror movie and a dark comedy push everything to the limit, then by all means watch The Greasy Strangler, but others, just stay away.
Yeah, this is for, like, fans of bizarro cult film only, because I can't imagine anybody else watching this and watching the whole thing. Like, it's just so repellent at times that it's hard to believe that it's at the same time compelling. I don't know. Like you, Robin, I have a hard time describing The Greasy Strangler. Maybe a good way to explain its weirdness is to say that every month I host streaming movie marathons of bad movies on Reddit. and a bunch of people come and we all watch bad movies together in a chat room with a synchronized video window. And I showed The Greasy Strangler to all these people who tuned in, and people were divided right down the middle. Some people thought that, like, they were angry that I was showing it because they didn't think it was actually a bad movie, whereas other people thought it was just the worst film ever made. And I kind of feel like that controversy, you know, nobody, it's so polarizing that there must be something to it. What is it? I don't know. When I think of The Greasy Strangler, rather than forming an opinion, I just find myself repeating those lines that they say over and over and over again in the movie. When I think of Greasy Strangler, I think, hootie tootie disco cutie, hootie tootie disco cutie. Which is, again, they spend at least 5 minutes of the movie just shouting that at each other over and over again. So if you like bizarre cult movies, you really should check out The Greasy Strangler. It's kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of a horrible masterpiece, I guess you could call it. It's somewhere between, like, Eraserhead and Street Trash, but also with, like, a dash of maybe something like Wes Anderson, with affected dialogue and, like, pastel-colored costumes. This movie is troubling because it clearly had a vision behind it. This was somebody's, like, idea. They didn't half-ass this. They really... Even saying that, I'm like, there are like at least four or five full asses in the movie. So, yeah, I mean, check it out if that sounds like your cup of tea.
Yes, this would be the ultimate movie where you show it to someone and you're worried that they will never speak to you again just for recommending it to them. It's that class of movie, but it is, it's worth sitting through just to say that you sat through it. It almost feels like a badge of honor just because it really is one of a kind.
You're basically the only, you and our buddy Vince Nitro are basically the only people that I could ever recommend The Greasy Strangler to. And it's short. Even though it feels like an eternity, it's only like 80 minutes long, and it is worth staying until the very end, because there is a moment at the end, I think I mentioned this when I reviewed it, where it just feels like the director was like, fuck it, if people are still around at this point, I'm just going to go totally insane, and the whole movie just like goes completely bonkers. It was weird before, but it was just like, it really is like the whole film just went, whatever, and threw up its hands and stopped making sense entirely. So it is worth sitting through for that, too.
Oh, definitely. Maybe we'll make TK watch it for our next anniversary show.
Robin, would
if
you...
If we're feeling that at him.
Yeah. You hear that, TK? Hey, it was produced by Ben Wheatley.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see, guys.
Robin, would you agree with my assessment that had I seen it last year, The Greasy Strangler would have been a strong contender for the most batshit movie of 2016?
Oh, absolutely. Like, Swiss Army Man is no comparison to that. Like, it had its juvenile humor, but it was very deep, and it seemed pretty low-key and respectable next to The Greasy Strangler, because you didn't see Daniel Radcliffe rubbing grease on himself and having floppy old man penis and stuff, so, I mean...
Well, thank goodness.
So, yeah, Greasy... Yeah, thank goodness for that. So, Greasy Strangler tops it by a mile, I'd say. And the last movie I briefly wanted to talk about that I watched with Gil is the latest Neil Breen movie, Pass Through. And I gotta say, Neil Breen never ceases to amaze me. Like, I've seen a lot of bad movies by bad directors, but Neil Breen is, I think he's on a whole nother level, because just watching, the best way to describe the first 30 minutes of Pass Through is, it's a bunch of stuff. Because literally, you will watch this movie for a half an hour, and it will just cut to random things, like shots of the desert, and shots of Neil Breen talking to, like, a CGI tiger, and Neil Breen lying on the ground in a bunch of garbage, and then him standing on top of a mountain, and it'll intercut to other characters, like a bunch of people trying to cross the border before they're captured by sex traffickers, I think. They don't really make it clear. And they cut to a bunch of kids in a bedroom working on astronomy, and then this crazy old professor in a bed with an oxygen tank and stuff. And there's like no transitions at these at all. They'll just cut to another scene and no consideration whatsoever to like how this stuff flows together. And it's just so incompetently made on so many levels. But, I guess the idea is that Neil Breen once again plays this otherworldly alien being who wants to end all the corruption in the world. And he's making these really social and political statements. And then eventually in the movie, you see him, the way that they hammer home these points is that he attends all these parties and all these fancy houses, which are all backscreen projections, and all these villains will say about all the evil things we do, like, oh, we like to cause a meltdown of the economy. And then it'll cut to Neil Breen say, but isn't that corrupt? But isn't that immoral? And then basically he causes all the corrupt and evil people in the world to just flat out disappear. But because this movie has no budget, the way they do it is that they have a newsroom that's a back projection screen with like three reporters. And then Neil Breen just appears and gives this long monologue in front of the TV saying that he has made all the evil people in the world disappear and put an end to corruption, and that he is going to make the human race start all over again. He always has these weird themes in all of his movies, like he's trying to make a big social point, but it just comes across so, so badly just because he's such a weird guy. And I don't know what it is about Neil Breen movies, because the way they're put together, they should be as boring as hell just because they're just long stretches where nothing happens, but they're oddly fascinating because you're wondering what's going through this guy's mind. Where is this movie going to go? What's going to happen next? How could he think he's a competent filmmaker? But I just can't explain the appeal to them, but I got to endorse that anyone who's a bad movie lover has to watch all of Neil Breen's movies. Like they even trump Tommy Wiseau with their bizarreness and stuff, because at least Tommy Wiseau knows how to stage a scene. He knows how to edit together a movie. He's got confidence, but Neil Breen, he looks like he's never watched a movie before, and he's making his own movie. I think that's the best way to describe it. So, but Pass Through, I think, out of all the weird ones he made, might be the weirdest out of all of them. So this is another one I'd say, if you're a fan of bad movies, check out Pass Through. But if you're not and you don't know who Neil Breen is, stay the hell away.
Neil Breen, in my opinion, is the modern Ed Wood. And I feel like there are very direct comparisons between Neil Breen and Ed Wood, and it's not, these aren't like intentional connections. It's not like Neil Breen was inspired by Ed Wood, but they both they both try to make statements in ridiculous sci-fi movies, like how Plan 9 from Outer Space is about like aliens and zombies, but it's also sort of like a cautionary tale about nuclear war, and you know how small the humans are and things like that. Just like Neil Breen, you know, it's a movie, like, for example, his film Double Down. In Double Down, he's like the world's greatest secret government special ops agent, bioterrorist hacker, who can cure cancer with his mind. Like, he's just the best at everything. But at the same time, you know, he sits in judgment of corrupt politicians, and he's trying to have a statement about how human beings should look past their differences, and how, you know, fighting over race is so shallow, and humans should really know that they're all just one species, and blah, 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 blah. So I definitely feel like Neil Breen is like a worthy successor to the Ed Wood throne. All he needs is a washed-up, out-of-work actor like Bela Lugosi to star in a few films, and the cycle will have completed itself again.
Yeah, maybe someone like Gary Busey would belong in one of these films. He'd fit perfectly.
Oh, man, yeah, that is a perfect collaboration. I would love to see Gary Busey in a Neil Breen movie, because the Buseyisms would fit so perfectly alongside Neil Breen's ridiculous rhetoric about him being like a caveman, but also an AI from the future who's come back in the form of a red, like, laser pointer dot.
Oh, yeah.
Man, I don't even know. Like Robin, I am very confused.
That red dot got a lot of screen time in that movie for whatever reason. But yeah, definitely Neil Breen's films are in a class of their own. And I also just want to give a shout-out to my latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. This one is a Unsolved Mysteries case called The Orange Sock Murders, and once again, it just smashed our record for downloads of one of our episodes on its first day. So obviously the Unsolved Mysteries cases I cover are popular. So be sure to check it out if you're a fan. And I also want to mention that it's only 1 month from now that I'll be appearing at CrimeCon on a panel of podcasters. So if any of you people living are in Indianapolis, then be sure to come see me. And that's about all I've been up to.
So we talked about just about everything I've been up to. I saw, you know, all the same movies as Robin, and then I saw Guardians of the Galaxy 2. But one thing nobody's mentioned is Better Call Saul. Are you guys caught up with it?
Yes, definitely.
I'm not caught up yet, I'm afraid.
Oh, man. Okay, I will avoid spoilers for TK's sake, but it was... The latest episode was the trial between Jimmy and Chuck about the tape, about Jimmy breaking into Chuck's place and destroying the tape. That whole rivalry has come to a head, and boy, does this episode end with a bang. I won't say more than that, but it really ended on an amazing note and some terrific acting. So Better Call Saul is still great. I'm so glad good TV is back. Rob, do you have any vague thoughts on it?
Yes, well, I know you were talking about our last episode about how well-written the relationship between Chuck and Jimmy is in this series, and this episode is just the crescendo in showing, like, the nature of the relationship. It's so well-handled and builds up so well, not to spoil anything, but the majority of this episode takes place in one location, but it is just compelling television all the way. Really well done.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. Actually, one other thing that I can talk about that I've been watching is American Gods. TK, have you watched American Gods, perchance?
No, I haven't watched the episode yet, which is shameful, I know.
So this is Brian Fuller, you know, the guy who brought us Hannibal. We loved Hannibal. Brian Fuller adapting my favorite Neil Gaiman book, a really big hit of a Neil Gaiman book, with an amazing cast playing all these characters. And so, I mean, this is a really tricky one. Before I even talk about my thoughts on the show itself, I will say this. Two episodes in, American Gods is not an accessible show. I feel like they're doing a good job compressing and adapting the book material, but someone who hasn't read the book is going to be so confused. There's so little cohesion between this material. And also, the show itself is like, it's like a fever dream. You know how in Hannibal we get like Will Graham's flashback hallucinations and just his mental illness making him see things, all these trippy sequences and extreme slow motion. There is a lot of that stuff in American Gods, and I think the casual viewer might be a little put off by it. It is gorgeous, and having read the book and knowing where it's all going, I think it's pretty cool. It doesn't always nail it. It misses the mark on a lot of things, but the majority of American Gods has been pretty cool for me. But like I said, yeah, I'm curious to see what you think, TK, because it is trippy as hell. Like, it's just trippy, surreal, avant-garde television. It's very avant-garde in its construction. And I kind of feel like a lot of people will watch this and go, what the hell is going on? I have no idea who any of these people are. But yeah, a final note on that, though, is the casting is terrific. Again, with my having read the book, I think all the casting is on point, to a T. Just absolutely perfect. And, related to that, last year, very early last year, shortly after I moved to Toronto, I recorded some auditions for American Gods, and after two episodes, I have now seen all the people whose auditions I recorded. They were all for very small parts, like bartender, flight attendant, and... the sister of Cloris Leachman's character in the second episode. Those three parts were ones that I recorded auditions for, so it was pretty cool seeing that as well, a little connection to the show. But I'd love to know what, not only TK, but what you would think, Robin. I'd be so curious because whenever I watch it, I can't help but think people are going to have no idea what's going on. Like, I get it because I know where it's all going, but I would be so lost otherwise. And that is all I've been up to. So now let's talk about Dame Helen Mirren. And we like to start off these career profile episodes by asking a couple of key questions. One of which is, do you like Helen Mirren's work? And the other, and when did you first become aware of her as an actor?
Well, the first time I ever saw her was during my childhood in the movie 2010, which is a sequel to 2001, A Space Odyssey, in which I think is a very underrated movie. And surprisingly enough, Helen Mirren played a Russian. It's like a story about this like American and Russian astronauts who combine on a mission to go to Jupiter. And what's funny is that the name of her character is Kubrick, which is an anagram of Kubrick, which is an inside joke. And she spends the entire movie like speaking in this thick Russian accent. And I don't know the next time I saw Helen Mirren, but for so many years, I actually assumed she really was Russian because she does a really convincing accent. But it wasn't until many years later that I found out that she was this very respected British actress. And of course, I think she's terrific. And I don't know who wouldn't think she's terrific.
TK, it probably goes without saying that you like Helen Mirren, right?
It's true. I do love Helen Mirren. And the first time I think I saw her was Gosford Park, actually. First major role I think I noticed her in.
I, too, am a fan. Who isn't, you know? Robin, you said it. It's like, who doesn't like Helen Mirren? I think that you can sort of rank her up there alongside Dame Judi Dench in terms of these British actresses who have, they have such class to them, and they have this very stern demeanor, but also kind of like a wicked sense of humor to them. I don't know. It's a very particular kind of actress, these dames, if you will. And so, yeah, I'm a big fan of Helen Mirren, and I have a funny story about the first time I became aware of Helen Mirren. The first thing I remember seeing her in was The Madness of King George, and I saw that movie in theaters when I was 11. And the story there is, I remember it so vividly, because it was definitely one of my most, like, boring movie-going experiences. I was this 11-year-old kid, I was at my friend's birthday party, and he wanted to go see a movie with all his friends at his birthday party, his 11th birthday party. We all wanted to go see Street Fighter with Van Damme. But when we got to the theater, Street Fighter wasn't playing anymore. So, thinking quick, Daniel's dad bought us all tickets to The Madness of King George. And I just remember being bored out of my frigging skull by this movie. Because I was like an 11-year-old kid. I wanted to go see Street Fighter. And instead I got this movie about, you know, this stuck-up king going slowly crazy because of, like, degenerative mental illnesses. And, you know, he's just getting old. And how does a monarchy deal with their ruler going off the deep end but not dying? What happens? And Helen Mirren is, of course, his wife, caught up in all of this. But boy, it will always stick with me as one of the worst times I've had at the movies, just because of the context. Because this was not a movie for an 11-year-old boy to watch. It was so uninteresting to me, and I just remember being restless throughout the running time. And at that age as well, you know, at 90 minutes, it feels like an eternity. So it was especially awkward and unpleasant. But that is how I came to know of Helen Mirren. I'm kind of amazed it didn't put me off her forever.
So you remember the time when you wanted to see Jean-Claude Van Damme more than Helen Mirren?
I wanted to be watching Jean-Claude Van Damme, and I got Helen Mirren, and I wasn't happy. But you know, these days, I probably would be. So, you know, we've talked a little bit about, you know, whether we like Helen Mirren. Maybe before we proceed to our favorite Helen Mirren roles, I should also ask you guys, Like, what is the appeal? Can you describe why we like Helen Mirren? We all agree, it sort of goes without saying, everybody likes Helen Mirren. Why do you think that is?
Well, you kind of talked about it in the intro of how she has this strong, forceful presence. Like, she never really plays like a weak character, like a female character who's like a moron or anything like that. Like, she's always playing these kind of strong-willed women and has this very like dignified, like forceful presence that commands the screen. And it's like you look at her filmography and it's like she may have done some like not always done great movies, but she always gives like a really like good performance in all of them and always makes an impression every time she's on screen.
TK, do you agree? What is the appeal of Dame Helen Mirren?
I think she just has a presence because like she's this small little woman, but I think she has this like commanding aura kind of thing. So she just like demands attention, and I think that she's well worth it.
Another aspect of this as well is obviously she's beautiful too, and I find her eyes to be especially piercing. She has these almost cat-like eyes that always seem to have a glint to them, and the result of that is that it's funny because, you know, she's been acting for a very long time, but it's as though she's had this renaissance late in her career, where now everybody wants to see her as this total badass, because even as an older woman, she still has that gleam in her eye, she still has that commanding attitude, and so we all kind of delight in seeing her, you know, wield a machine gun or turn up in something like The Fate of the Furious bossing Jason Statham around. So, yeah, there is definitely, she definitely has a presence to her, doesn't she? So let's talk about our favorite Helen Mirren roles or Helen Mirren movies. Robin, what is your number three?
My number three is one of her earlier roles, and that's with Bob Hoskins in the movie The Long Good Friday, which I think is a really underrated gangster film and was the film that jump-started Bob Hoskins' career. And I was talking about how she plays strong-willed, dignified women. Well, that's definitely the case here because this is your standard rise and fall of a gangster movie, and she plays kind of the gangster's moll. But she plays her as like a very strong, like dignified character. Like in a lot of these movies, sometimes the role of like the gangster's wife is like portrayed as a train wreck, but she comes across as this like really respectable woman who is like really devoted to her husband. What's great about it is that it's kind of an unusual structure where you don't actually see the bad things that this character that Bob Hoskins plays, Harold, did. Like you see his downfall, but what's unique is that the downfall isn't really his fault. He's kind of a guy who's rose to the top of the ladder and is trying to become respectable and go legitimate. And now that he's on the precipice, things start falling apart for him, but you don't actually see him do anything bad, even though he probably did a lot of bad things in the past. So you feel like really sorry for these characters. Like, even Helen Mirren's character, even though her husband is obviously a criminal, you can tell that she like genuinely loves him and cares about him, and like these characters really don't do anything to deserve the things that happen to them as well. And I think she has great chemistry with Bob Hoskins, and her last scene in the movie is just kind of so horrifying, where Hoskins like gets into like a car and he realizes that it's being driven by his enemies who are gonna take him out and kill him, and then he turns around and he sees Helen Mirren's character is in another car being taken away, and she's like screaming for him and stuff, and you don't actually see what happens to her, so it's left ambiguous about whether or not they're actually going to take her and kill her, and you feel like so horrible for her. But yeah, it's a very strong performance, and I kind of wish she had done more movies with Bob Hoskins, because I thought they were terrific together in this. It's one of her more underrated performances, but it's one of her best.
I watched this, I think, on your recommendation, or did you make us watch this for the podcast? I'm trying to remember.
I'm sure I recommended it to you, but I don't think I made you watch it as the podcast.
I think it was when we were talking about Bob Hoskins. This was a recommendation of yours. I really enjoyed this movie as well. It's in my honorable mentions, and yeah, I like how Helen Mirren, what a great role it is for Helen Mirren, because she is this sort of, it's not quite one of those like power behind the throne roles that you might get. You know, you were mentioning how a lot of crime drama movies, have the gangster's wife, you know, it being weak or being threatened, being a bit of a damsel, or maybe even being dumb. But Helen Mirren is, you know, they have this chemistry, and she's this really supportive person. So, yeah, I think it's a really neat take on that type of character archetype, and you can get anybody else to play it better. TK, I can't remember. Did you watch The Long Good Friday?
No, I can't say I have, I'm afraid, but it sounds super good.
TK, what is your number three?
Mine is actually Gosford Park. Sorry. Mine is actually Gosford Park, like this high society woman that's taking part in this murder scheme. Because she's so, because I hadn't seen her before, and she was just so kind of entrancing. I was just kind of amazed at, again, like I was saying before, her presence and her timbre and like the way she held herself. And it made me wish that I could have seen her like live on stage at some point, because I think she'd just be electric. And like I enjoy Gosford Park quite a bit, so it's kind of fun to see her, hike around in one of the movies I respect so much, I think.
So it's been a long time since I watched Gosford Park, and I regret that I remember finding it kind of boring, but it may be just a symptom of, you know, Robert Altman pictures. They're a very particular brand of talky feel. They're almost like mumblecore before mumblecore was a movement. And when I saw it, it had just come out in theaters. I saw it at the Bytown Theater back in Ottawa, and yeah, it didn't really do it for me. It's one of those things where I respected the film, I really liked the cast, but the content didn't resonate as much. Robin, have you seen Gosford Park?
Yeah, not since it originally came out, and I kind of felt the same way at the time, that it was an excellent cast and great period of detail, but I didn't really get immersed and involved in it so much. I don't remember too much about her role in it, unfortunately, but I would like to maybe check it out again, because it sounds like this is one of those movies where you pick up more on a second viewing.
So my number three... I'm going back to my childhood again. This is a film that I did see after The Madness of King George. So it wasn't the first time I became aware of Helen Mirren, but I know a lot of people who, when they were kids, like me, loved fantasy movies, especially like 80s fantasy movies. So Excalibur is kind of a prime example of this. And this movie is, I don't know, it's pretty silly. It's a bit like Legend in a lot of ways, with sort of Tangerine Dream style music and a lot of you know, shiny chrome armor with green lights reflected in it. It's a very particular kind of 80s fantasy look, but it's pretty fun, pretty interesting take on the Arthurian legend. Certainly more interesting than the Guy Ritchie one that we're about to get. It's got a great cast, including Gabriel Byrne and little side roles for Liam Neeson and Patrick Stewart as well, which are pretty awesome. But Helen Mirren plays Morgana, who seduces Arthur and then has his son Mordred, who would, of course, go on to be Arthur's downfall. And it's a really great role for Helen Mirren, where she gets to, you know, she has a great agent, because her agent always gets her into movies where she gets to wear awesome costumes and look really good in them. And I kind of love all of her outfits as Morgana in Excalibur. It's a totally silly 80s fantasy movie, but it's pretty fun. You know, if you like that, if you like this particular brand of fantasy film, you'll enjoy Excalibur, and it's got Helen Mirren in it. Have you guys seen Excalibur, perchance?
Not for a long time, no, so I don't remember too much about her role in it, but it's interesting you mentioned that this had, like, Liam Neeson and Patrick Stewart in, like, early roles before they were famous, because I would love to see a fantasy movie come out these days with those three actors together.
Seriously, and it's also got, like, Kieran Hines in it. Just a lot of, you know, a lot of small parts for actors who would go on to big things. TK, have you seen Excalibur?
I actually haven't. It's one of those ones that's sadly missing. I'll have to pick up on it at some point.
I'm really surprised you haven't seen that one. I have to say, because, like, this is a nostalgic favorite of mine, but as a movie, it's pretty ridiculous. You'll probably laugh, and it does do that sort of legend style Tangerine Dream surreal imagery with synth music, 80s fantasy thing that Legend did. So, at your own risk, you've been warned. Robin, what is your number two?
My number two is a movie that I praised a lot last year. I think it made my top three favorite movies of the year, and that's Eye in the Sky, where she plays the role of Colonel Powell, a colonel in the British Army who has to decide whether to use a drone to fire a missile at a house that may be housing terrorists, even though it could cause collateral damage with the death of civilians, one of whom is a young girl. And this is such a prime role for her because it's another one of her great strong-willed characters where there's times you really want to despise her, but times when you can perfectly understand her motivation. And I think it was pretty cool to cast a woman in this role because as written, you would kind of think that they could have put a male into this role, but I think it gives like her character, her role, extra pizzazz that she's like a woman in kind of a male dominated industry, that she's a woman in power who wants to prove herself. And I just love the sparring she does back and forth with Alan Rickman's character, even though they're technically not even in the same room. She pretty much plays her entire role inside a control room where she wants to fire the drone at any cost, no matter whether it causes the deaths of civilians. And it's kind of neat as the movie goes on where she finds these like little loopholes to figure out a way to like fire the missile while giving herself plausible deniability, where it's like even if she causes some civilian casualties, she can cover her ass and not get in any trouble. And sometimes she seems despicable doing it, but other times you kind of see her point of view, where it's like if we don't fire this, a lot more people will die in the long run. So like I said, it's a challenging movie where the majority of the action just takes place in like a handful of rooms, so you need great actors to pull it off, but she does, and pretty much her and Alan Rickman and Aaron Paul and the entire cast does like an outstanding job at making this one of the most compelling thrillers that came out this last year. So yeah, it's a great movie, great showcase for Alan Rickman in his last role, and a great role for Helen Mirren as well.
So I'm kicking myself because you've recommended this so many times, and I still have not sat down to watch Eye in the Sky. So I'm resolving here and now. On the next episode, I will review this film. I'm going to watch it and finally get around to it because you've spoken highly of it. And again, with, you know, the final, one of the final on-screen, it is the final on-screen appearance of Alan Rickman and Helen Mirren in the lead role. What am I doing? I'm just dawdling. TK, have you seen Eye in the Sky?
No.
Ooh. Okay. Well, are you gonna watch it? Because I'm gonna watch it.
I will at some point, but maybe not by next week.
All right. TK, what is your number two?
Oh, sorry. My number two is actually Red because I really like this movie. I think the first one is a lot of fun. The second one, little. Less so, but I think the chemistry between Mirren and the rest of the cast goes a really long way, especially her and Mary Louise Parker. And I just think it's such a fun concept, and she turns out to be this like bazooka carrying badass, and it's just so much fun to watch her throw her weight around, and she looks like she's having a really good time playing like the semi action role, which I don't think she's really done. So it was kind of fun to see her stretch her muscle like that. And again, it's one of those ones that it's so weirdly out of character for her that it's so much fun to watch her in it.
So Red is actually my number one, and it's funny, I think you've actually praised the film more than I'm going to. I thought Red as a movie was an enjoyable enough film, but the thing that makes it is that this is the perfect marriage of actor and role, with Helen Mirren playing a retired spy, and we really, this was the film that really, I feel like without Red, we wouldn't have gotten Helen Mirren in The Fate of the Furious. This is the film that put a machine gun in her hand and made everybody go like, oh, like she's a total badass, and, you know, want to see more of that. So, for me, Red is really all about Helen Mirren. Sure, you know, John Malkovich is entertainingly crazy. Bruce Willis is kind of just whispering his way through the lead guy role. I like Mary Louise Parker, but this is the Helen Mirren show for me, guys. It was revelatory to see her in this kind of action role at her age. It's pretty darn cool, and it set a real trend. Robin, what do you think of Red?
Oh, yes, it's one of my honorable mentions, and I figured it would show up on one of your guys' lists. And it's kind of a case where if she was not in it, it would be an enjoyable but completely forgettable film because it is a pretty routine plot. But just, like, at the time, it just seemed so bizarre to see this woman cast as an action hero. But the novelty of it is what intrigued me to see the film, and she handles it so well. And the fact that she's pretty much the toughest character in the film, that she's this former assassin who is pretty much should be retired, but she pretty much gets the urge to kill. Like, you just kind of think of her character and how dark it is that she's the kind of person who says, well, I tried retirement and being a homemaker, and it just doesn't work for me, so I want another contract to go killing people again. But it works so well, and she makes the character likable. And I also love the way she constantly has this love-hate relationship with Brian Cox throughout the movie, where they're kind of flirting with each other and sniping with each other the whole time. It's pretty fun. So yeah, if it wasn't for her, like, as a movie, Red is probably not the best movie she's been in, but she pretty much single-handedly elevates it, and it was, it paved the way for her being in The Fate and the Furious, and it didn't feel out of place when she did it, and you kind of wish that she had actually done more of the stuff that she did in Red and The Fate of the Furious. If I have one complaint about that movie, is that I really wanted to see her driving a car off a cliff or something and doing a cool stunt, but alas, it was not to be. But she definitely is a lot of fun in Red.
So my number two, we're seeing a trend here. You know, we've already... Robin, you've already talked about how Helen Mirren is the kind of actress who you cast in a role that may have been written for a man to play originally. You know, the kind of role that she would play in Eye in the Sky. And here is a case where they quite literally cast her in a man's part, and it is perfect. She is perfect. That is in the film The Tempest, the Julie Taymor adaptation of Shakespeare's play. And sadly, I mean, this is a case where we're dealing with Shakespeare, so the material has an inherent quality to it, I would say. And Julie Taymor had done a great Shakespearean adaptation before with Titus. Julie Taymor has a really interesting visual style, and it looks great on film. That said, Taymor's work can be pretty flawed. Let us not forget that Spider-Man musical she tried to put on. Sometimes it just doesn't work, and I think that that's the case with parts of The Tempest. It is visually rich, but it's not always great. It's sort of an interesting choice to adapt. However, Helen Mirren as Prospero, or I guess Prospera, they may have changed the character's name, but Prospero, just, you know, the sort of almost like a Gandalf-style character, the old wizard who lives by the sea and, you know, can conjure spells. Helen Mirren is awesome in that role. It's this big, like, meaty role for her, and she is just, she looks great in all the costumes. It's just another case of perfect casting, and another example of Helen Mirren being cast in a part where she is powerful, she's playing this powerful character, and she's also playing a character that may have been written for a dude, and I think probably doing a better job. I can't think of any other actor who has played Prospero, but I can think of Helen Mirren, because she really owned that role. Have you guys seen The Tempest?
No, I haven't, unfortunately.
TK, have you seen The Tempest?
Yeah, I have seen The Tempest, and that's on my honorable mentions list, because, like, say what you will about Sofia Coppola, and, like, her films can get a little messy.
It's Julie Taymor.
That's right. I really like this. I really enjoyed this film. It's a lot of fun. But, and she is, again, commanding as Prospero. It's fantastic.
All right, Robin. So, number one.
Well, I gotta go with the one that actually won her the Academy Award, and that's The Queen, where she plays Queen Elizabeth II, and nobody could have pulled off this role better than her, I think. She's absolutely perfect in the role. And I think it's appropriate to talk about this one right now, because we were talking about how the Lost City of Z was pretty much like a Wikipedia biopic about Percy Fawcett, where it just decided to take all the interesting stuff from his life and just throw it out there, and it became an unsatisfying movie. Whereas The Queen does not decide to become a biopic about Queen Elizabeth II. It decides to focus mainly on one week in her life, like the response to when Princess Diana died. And I think that's a terrific narrative. It shows, like, the character at her, because she's dealing with, like, the cry about a death, about a woman she really didn't like that much, but she has to kind of maintain her dignity and face the public and issue a statement, even though she really doesn't want to, because and they pretty much go into her backstory just kind of with exposition, where it's kind of like they mention how she was put in this position when she was younger, even though she didn't really want it, but she has held the position with dignity for over like 50 years. And Mirren enhances it so much, where throughout the film you see her having like a big rivalry with like Tony Blair, the Prime Minister, and stuff, where he finds like a lot of the stuff she does annoying, but he is still mesmerized with her and caught in her spell because he admires just like the way she carries herself and how she pretty much holds like the responsibility of an entire country for over 50 years. And Mirren exemplifies that so well. Like, there's this one moment in the film halfway through where she's out on her own, like on the family lands, and she finally gets a moment to herself, and she kind of like briefly cries for like 10 seconds or something because she's overwhelmed with the attention she's getting, but then she sees a deer and she suddenly becomes happy again. And then when people come to find her, she starts being the queen again, all dignified and proper and not showing any emotion. And it just exemplifies the character so well. And it was so cool to see her finally get an Academy Award after her long career, because even though movies like this are considered, they're kind of like Oscar bait, like they're made just to win people Academy Awards, she definitely deserved it for this performance.
I mean, she's perfect to play royalty, right? You know, we talk about being commanding and having that air of authority, and also being exuding class and being so very British. She really is just perfect to play royalty. And looking through her filmography, you see it everywhere. In TV miniseries, she's played Elizabeth I. Then the people, I believe it was the writer of the movie The Queen, also did a stage show called The Audience, and she played Queen Elizabeth II again in that. She's played Princess Evelyn Butcher in a TV miniseries, The Snow Queen, just royalty. She's meant to have a title. She has a title in real life. So, yeah, like you said, Robin, this is another example of just great casting, and I can't think of anyone else who would have been right for this part except for Helen Mirren. And perhaps some good evidence of that is when I was preparing my notes for this podcast, I was watching clips from The Queen, and I watched a clip where the Queen, you know, addresses the nation on television, makes a statement about Princess Diana's death. And in the YouTube suggested videos, I saw a thumbnail, and I was like, oh, is somebody parodying this scene? But no, it was actually the real Queen Elizabeth broadcast. It's almost like I had dismissed the real Queen and just thought of Helen Mirren as being Queen Elizabeth II. So she is definitely perfect for this part, absolutely. TK, have you seen The Queen?
The Queen's my number one as well. Again, mostly because of her incredibly amazing performance. And again, it was the one that put her absolutely everywhere. I don't know what else I can say to it that Robin hasn't added. I was actually going to reference that one scene that you talked about with her on her own. That's funny.
I think the fact that she has returned in like this quasi-sequel, this sort of continuation called The Audience, I think that that's, you know, it just further supports the argument that this is perfect casting. She is ideal to play Queen Elizabeth II. And she's going to do it again and again. We've already mentioned my number one, which was Red, but I have a couple of little things that I'd like to mention. They're not really honorable mentions. They're just funny things that I came upon as I was researching Helen Mirren's career. And the first is her appearance on Jimmy Kimmel I think it was 2 years. It was before he hosted the Oscars, but Jimmy Kimmel would do an Oscar follow-up show, and he'd get like all the nominees together to make a trailer for like the ultimate movie with all the Oscar winners or Oscar nominees. And I remember one where, you know, they were doing the funny montage of the trailer going like starring everybody. And when it gets to Helen Mirren, it's starring Helen Mirren fighting a kraken on a hovercraft. And it's just her on a hovercraft swatting at these tentacles, and she says, "Get off my hovercraft!" And it's all we need. And, yeah, highly amusing. It's just, she's so serious, but she's clearly not afraid to not take herself seriously.
And I'm sure she's going to do a movie like that for real eventually.
I mean, I hope so, because I'll watch that. I'd watch a whole movie of Helen Mirren fighting krakens while riding on a hovercraft. And then the other thing that I found, this is a real little gem that I stumbled across, and I wish I knew where it was from. So, you know, Helen Mirren has been an actress for quite a long time. She started her career in the 60s. And very early on, I guess this was like right early on in her career, she did I don't know if this is a clip from a movie or a music video, but it's on YouTube. It's labeled as being made in 1967, so it's a really young Helen Mirren singing a song called "Too Drunk to Fuck" while wearing a skimpy costume and making like sexy eyes at the camera. I don't know where this is from, but boy, it caught me off guard as I was searching YouTube for Helen Mirren clips. So I recommend checking it out, because it is a really weird oddity, and I'd love to know if anybody can tell me if it was just like, did she write this song? Is she just in a music video for this song? Is this from a movie? You can't really tell, because she's singing to the camera the whole time. So yeah.
I actually think I put up a Before They Were Stars clip of it years ago, and I think it was from a movie called Herostratus, which was her film debut, and I don't know if it was a big role or not, and I really don't know anything about the context of the song or the clip, but it is from a movie.
Herostratus. Well, you're right. Here it is. Robin, to the rescue. All those years of doing Before They Were Stars posts have finally paid off, but this is totally worth looking into. Watch this clip. What the hell?
And she was a very attractive woman back in the 60s.
Yeah, she really was. And it's interesting. I've seen people comparing her to Jennifer Lawrence. And they do look very similar when Helen Mirren was Jennifer Lawrence's age. They had a very similar appearance. So I wonder if when we're all really old geezers, if we'll revisit this topic and talk about how, oh yeah, Jennifer Lawrence, she was made to play, you know, Queen Elizabeth the, what, fifth, or depending on how many queens we go through. Do you guys have any honorable mentions?
Ooh, I do. Caligula.
Ah, yeah.
I've still never seen Caligula.
Oh, you're not. You know what? I was just going to say you're not missing anything, but you are missing spectacle. And that's all there is.
Really. I mean, Malcolm McDowell's pretty amazing in it.
Oh, my God. Brutal.
And she is playing like royalty again and getting to dress up in those awesome costumes.
Yeah, it's fun.
While I of course looked up on YouTube some clips from Caligula to refresh my memory of Helen Mirren in it, and you can find a really great behind the scenes clip of her where she talks about how it's, what does she say? It's something along the lines of, this film is, it's this beautiful period piece, but it's also filled with genitalia, or something along those lines. Sums it up. Do you have any others, TK?
I enjoyed her small role in Trumbo, and hang on a second, I had another one written down here, and now I can't find my list. So you guys go ahead.
Robin, do you have any honorable mentions?
I also loved her role in Trumbo as Hedda Hopper, the gossip colonist. She's such an evil bitch in that one. Also loved her role in Hitchcock, playing Alfred Hitchcock's wife, Alma Revel, who technically had to take over the production of Psycho for a while for her husband, so it was kind of interesting to see her backstory. And I also remember her in the movie State of Play with Russell Crowe and Ben Affleck, where she plays the editor of the newspaper, and it's not a big role, but she pretty much steals like every scene that she's in, and you kind of wish there was more of her in it.
You guys have touched upon most of the ones that I have in my honorable mentions, but one that you haven't brought up yet is her sort of cameo role as the voice of the supercomputer Deep Thought in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And what's interesting about The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is that it is so based around voiceover. The narration, you know, like the sort of side narration, I don't know what the proper narrative term is for it, but in the book, the asides, like where it says, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy defines this as that, those are the best parts of the book, not even the plot. You know, the best stuff is the actual content of the guide. And in the movie, that voiceover is translated to literal voiceover, where you have a narrator speaking to you, and it's Stephen Fry is the voice of The Hitchhiker's Guide itself. And I like that to contrast that when it comes to the world's smartest supercomputer, or the universe's most, you know, smartest supercomputer, created to answer the ultimate question of life, the universe, and everything, rather than the authoritative, professorial, British Stephen Fry voice, they went with the sort of stern and commanding British female voice of Helen Mirren for Deep Thought. It's kind of it's a cool thing that I noted. I like that, you know, you have these two voices. It's like they're both equally commanding, but for different ways. Now, what about the worst, guys? Can you tell me the worst Helen Mirren movie?
Yes, this is a movie where Helen Mirren is quite entertaining in it, but the movie itself is pretty terrible, and it's Teaching Mrs. Tingle.
Hey, that's my worst as well.
Yeah, I kind of figured it would be. It's such a stupid premise where it's like these three kids who like tire up, I think, and try to force this teacher to give them like a better grade or something like that, or not suspend her. And you see Helen Mirren go after these kids with a crossbow. Like it's so stupid, but at least she sinks her teeth into it and gives it her all. But my God, this movie is just so far beneath her.
Yeah, this was another memorable like early exposure to Helen Mirren for me, because I remember renting this on home video on VHS in the late 90s and watching it and just thinking it was really dumb. But I do remember that the plot was Katie Holmes in her like Dawson's Creek years, she needs an A to get into this prestigious college, and she gets caught cheating on the exam, and she tries to, like, explain that, oh, she wasn't cheating, it was her friend who was cheating, but no, Mrs. Tingle, her evil history teacher, is not having it, and so they basically hold their history teacher hostage. It's pretty dumb. It's written by Kevin Williamson, the guy who did Scream, but also the guy who did Cursed. You ever wonder why we don't hear about Kevin Williamson anymore? Yeah, it's movies like this. And I should also note, this is a movie that could only be made in the 90s, because, my God, so much student-teacher, you know, threats of violence and death. I don't think this would fly if you made this movie today.
I do remember that I actually ordered this in a hotel, and my dad saw the bill and wondered if I had ordered a porn film because of the title.
Teaching Mrs. But, Tingle.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like one, but it's like, no, it has Dame Helen Mirren. What are you talking about?
Scandalous. TK, do you have a pick for the worst?
Yeah, Collateral Beauty is a terrible,
oh yeah,
burning garbage heap of a film, and she is okay in it, but like Jesus Christ, it just it's what she's working with, and it's all garbage.
In addition to Teaching Mrs. Tingle, I also have National Treasure: Book of Secrets. I mean,
oh yes,
oh boy, yeah. The less said about that, the better, I guess. Is that? Do we have any final thoughts on Helen Mirren as we wrap up this conversation?
I would gladly watch another Fast and the Fate of the Furious spinoff just about Jason Statham and her as his mother. I really want to see a movie just about that family so that she will make more of those movies.
I am generally against remakes, but I would be interested in seeing just about any remake of an action movie where Helen Mirren is cast in what was formerly a man's part. Like, I don't, just name any action movie that they might remake where it's a dude in the leading role and cast Helen Mirren instead and tell me you wouldn't watch it. The Terminator, but Helen Mirren instead of Schwarzenegger. Right? Like,
oh yes.
I would absolutely, heck, even something that I consider sacred, like Escape from New York with Helen Mirren as Snake Plissken. I would watch the hell out of that. Hollywood, take note. Here's your recipe for success.
And we need your clothes, your boots, and your motorcycle.
Oh my god. I would watch it. I would so watch it. TK, any final thoughts on Helen Mirren?
Just keep doing what she's doing, Helen. You're fantastic.
She really is. Well, on that note, it is now time to play The Ticket Price is Right, the box office prediction game, where we try to predict the opening weekend box office grosses of movies being released this week, and we also look back on last week's predictions. We were actually gone for a week. We missed Guardians of the Galaxy, which would have been a real tug of war. But last time, we were predicting the opening totals for The Circle and How to Be a Latin Lover. Neither of these movies did especially well. The Circle, it did terribly. I won this one. I had the low bid with $10 million. I made $9 million. And then How to Be a Latin Lover, well, wouldn't you know it? Who knows better how to be a Latin lover than TK? TK won it. It actually did much better than any of us thought. TK had the high bid with $7.5 million and made $12 million. So TK, you're still way out in the lead with 11. I'm in second place with 6 points. Robin, you have 5. Robin's in last place. TK is in the lead. What is going on?
Dogs and cats living together.
This has never happened before. Well, this time we have a couple of movies coming out, and it's going to be very interesting to see how these go down. First up is Guy Ritchie's King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. Guys, I mean, this is not going to be Excalibur. It's not going to be Excalibur. It has a budget of $175 million. How did it get that much money? That's Jupiter Ascending money, guys.
Yeah.
Robin, how much is King Arthur going to make opening weekend?
Well, I don't know if it'll be terrible. Maybe it'll make $30 million, but I don't see it making like anywhere near its budget.
I'm going to go lower than that and say $25 million. TK, King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. How much will it
be? Guardians is still out. I'm going to go 15.
15. It is just going to get clobbered by Guardians of the Galaxy. Next up is Snatched. It's a mother-daughter slapstick Judd Apatow-style movie with Goldie Hawn and Amy Schumer. It has a budget of $42 million. Robin, how much do you think Snatched is going to make?
15, I guess.
15. I'll go a little higher. I'm going to say $20 million. I don't think it's going to do incredible, but I think it'll be maybe a little better. TK, Snatched, what do you think?
10. This looks really bad.
Yeah, it does not look good. As a side note, I just think it's kind of great that Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell both have movies coming out right now. It's like,
yep,
it's like win-win for them. You know, maybe Snatch won't do very good, but Guardians of the Galaxy is doing great. So there you go. Maybe they can get Goldie Hawn in on the next Guardians of the Galaxy.
Or Helen Mirren.
Oh my god, why not? Like, Helen Mirren is Groot. Tell me you wouldn't see it. You'd watch that. And it's not even like a CGI tree. It's just Helen Mirren
saying, "I am Groot," over and over again.
I'd watch it. I really would. Now it is time for TK's favorite segment, the Dumb Joke of the Week. This man is traveling through France, and he stops by at a monastery to see if he can spend the night. And he's heard that this monastery, the monks there, cook the most delicious potatoes. So he arrives, and the monks gladly give him a bed for the night, and then take him down to the kitchen, where he comes upon a man cooking potatoes in the kitchen. And the traveler says, "Are you the French friar?" And the man turns to him and says, "No, I'm the chipmunk."
Oh, my God.
you know, that wasn't too bad. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do so at the back row. You can contact TK by emailing tk@the-back-row.com. Robin can be reached by emailing robin.warder@the-back-row.com. Be sure to check out The Trail Went Cold at trailwentcold.com, Robin's weekly true crime podcast. And if you're in the Indianapolis area about a month from now, go to CrimeCon and meet Robin in person. Now is your chance. And of course, you can read all of Robin's writing at crack.com, listverse.com, and the-back-row.com. And you can find all of my stuff at the back row as well, the-back-row.com. There's also my video editing portfolio at mcgillfoot.com, and you can find links to all the other projects I'm involved with through the back row. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week. Shouts from the Back Row is part of the Back Row Podcast Network. Visit the-back-row.com for more. The Shouts from the Back Row theme is composed by Vince Nitro.